Chapter 19 of the Law of God. Section 1. God gave to Adam a law as a covenant of works, by which he bound him and all his posterity to personal, entire, exact, and perpetual obedience, promised life upon the fulfilling, and threatened death upon the breach of it, and endued him with power and ability to keep it. Section 2. This law, after his fall, continued to be a perfect rule of righteousness, and as such was delivered by God upon Mount Sinai in 10 commandments, and written in 2 tables, the first 4 commandments containing our duty toward God, and the other 6 our duty to man. This chapter begins by repeating some material from chapters 6 and 7. In the beginning, God imposed certain laws on Adam. These laws are not all spelled out in the early chapters of Genesis. In fact, all that is explicitly commanded is that Adam and Eve should propagate the race, subdue nature, cultivate Eden, and should not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It is implied, however, that Adam was to observe the Sabbath day and worship God, and, after the fall at least, he was to offer certain sacrifices. Moreover, the story of Cain and Abel requires us to believe that God had forbidden murder. It would seem likely, therefore, that God had given Adam all the 10 commandments. Later, after the flood, these commands were repeated. Now, unfortunately, among the fundamentalists, a certain group talks so as to give the impression that God gave no laws before the days of Moses. These people divide time into several dispensations, which are distinguished by different plans of salvation. They speak of a dispensation of conscience, a later dispensation of human government, and only with Moses is the dispensation of law supposed to begin. This dispensational view, in addition to being inconsistent with Genesis, is directly contradicted in Romans 5:13-14. These verses say, until the law, here Paul refers to the Mosaic law, sin was in the world. That is to say, people before the time of Moses were sinners. But, continues Paul, sin is not imputed where there is no law. Nevertheless, sin very obviously was imputed before the days of Moses, because death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over infants that had not sinned voluntarily after the similitude of Adam's transgression. Accordingly, there must have been law between Adam and Moses, because the penalty of disobedience was exacted. There is further evidence of a moral law imposed by God on man before and apart from the Mosaic Code as such. God not only gave specific commands, such as to keep the Sabbath day and to subdue nature, but he also provided man with an innate moral endowment, referred to in Romans 1:32 and 2:15. This is the law written on the hearts of even the heathen. How extensive it was in the case of Adam is hard to say, and since the fall has defaced the image of God in man, these innate moral principles are woefully ineffective. But in a preceding chapter it was said that responsibility is based on knowledge. The heathen, who have never heard the gospel of salvation, are nonetheless responsible for their sins, because of this original endowment of knowledge, which is part of the divine image in which man was created. The dispensationalists go on and place a dispensation of grace after the dispensation of law. In this dispensation, that is, the present age, law has no place. But once again, the Scripture contradicts such a view. The 3 chapters of Romans, where our freedom from the law of sin and death is most emphasized, are far from disparaging the law. In addition to the strong insistence on the necessity of a righteous life, Romans 6:2, 6:12, 15, 8:1, 4:13, Paul asserts that the law is holy and good, Romans 7:12, spiritual, 7:14, a delight to the godly man, 7:22, and the rule of service, 7:25. The Scriptures do not, in fact, speak of being free from the law, that is, from the moral law, whether expressed in the Ten Commandments or elsewhere. Romans 6:18-22 speak of being free from sin. Romans 7:3 refers to a widow who is no longer bound to her deceased husband. She is free to marry again, but she is not free to commit adultery. Romans 8:2 says that one law has freed us from another law. The only sense in which we are free from the moral law is that we are free from its penalty. We are never free to disobey God's commands. Section 3. Besides this law, commonly called moral, God was pleased to give to the people of Israel as a church under age, ceremonial laws containing several typical ordinances, partly of worship, prefiguring Christ, his graces, actions, sufferings, and benefits, and partly holding forth diverse instructions of moral duties, all which ceremonial laws are now abrogated under the New Testament. Section 4. To them also, as a body politic, he gave sundry judicial laws which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any other now further than the general equity thereof may require. Section 5. The moral law doth forever bind all, as well justified persons as others, to the obedience thereof, and that not only in regard of the matter contained in it, but also in respect of the authority of God, the Creator, who gave it. Neither doth Christ in the gospel any way dissolve, but much strengthen this obligation. In addition to these pre-Mosaic laws, God gave to his chosen people a ceremonial law or ritual. These sacrifices, sacraments, and procedures were typical of the full gospel yet to be revealed. The church in the Old Testament was the church as a minor. In its immaturity, though it was the heir, it was placed under a tutorship. But the tutorship was temporary, for Christ fulfilled the old types and his death did away with those preparatory sacrifices. Thus, the church in the New Testament is continuous with the church in the Old. And since we are Christ's, we are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Galatians 3:23-4:7. The Old Testament also prescribes certain civil laws for the nation of Israel. The details of these laws are not obligatory on other nations, though the principles of equity that underlie them are. But to say that Christians are no longer subject to the moral law is to say that Christians are free to worship idols, use profanity, ignore the Lord's Day, commit murder, adultery, and theft, and to live a life that the New Testament plainly condemns. Cf. Romans 13:8-10, 1 Corinthians 7:19, Ephesians 6:2, 1 John 2:3-8. Christ does not dissolve our obligation. He strengthens it. Cf. Matthew 5:19, Romans 3:31. Section 6. Although true believers be not under the law as a covenant of works, to be thereby justified or condemned, yet is it of great use to them as well as to others, in that as a rule of life, informing them of the will of God and their duty, it directs and binds them to walk accordingly, discovering also the sinful pollutions of their nature, heart, and lives, so as, examining themselves thereby, they may come to further conviction of humiliation for and hatred against sin, together with a clearer sight of the need they have of Christ and the perfection of his obedience. It is likewise of use to the regenerate to restrain their corruptions in that it forbids sin, and the threatenings of it serve to show what even their sins deserve, and what afflictions in this life they may expect for them, although freed from the curse thereof threatened in the law. The promises of it in like manner show them God's approbation of obedience, and what blessings they may expect upon the performance thereof, although not as due to them by the law as a covenant of works. So as a man's doing good and refraining from evil, because the law encourageth to the one and deterreth from the other, is no evidence of his being under the law and not under grace. Section 7. Neither are the forementioned uses of the law contrary to the grace of the gospel, but do sweetly comply with it. The Spirit of Christ, subduing and enabling the will of man to do that freely and cheerfully which the will of God revealed in the law requireth to be done. Section 6 gives several indications of how the law is of use to Christians. Not only are there these applications to our private lives, but also anyone who has a position of responsibility in the church must pay attention to the law. For example, a certain denomination of which I am not a member sponsored a Christmas service in which part of the worship, what word shall I use, was performed by a troupe of ballet dancers. When I remarked upon being pressed for an opinion that ballet was a bit incongruous with divine worship, one of their ministers replied that any excuse that stimulates love of humanity is appropriate in church. Then I tried to tell him of the Puritan principle and of the law of God from which we should not turn aside, either to the right hand or to the left. And since this minister expatiated on love versus law, I quoted, "If ye love me, keep my commandments." But he concluded the conversation politely enough by saying that my viewpoint appeared legalistic to him. Some ministers who prefer to be known as evangelicals rather than as liberals also attempt to substitute love for law, but they never explain how love can decide what is right and what is wrong. Does love tell us to keep the Sabbath day holy, or does it tell us to watch TV in the evening? Does love tell us to tithe our income, or give more, or to give less? Is it not clear that love cannot give directions in any specific case? What is needed is law, that is, divine precepts that are applicable to particular situations. This is not legalism. Legalism, or justification by works, is the unscriptural teaching that man can merit heaven by his own efforts. And it is especially strange when modernists, who have rejected the gracious sacrifice of Christ, should accuse anyone of being legalistic. But the meanings of words often get twisted these days, both in religion and in politics. The moral law also provides principles for the conduct of our civil affairs. It does not spell out the details, but it sets limits and furnishes norms. For example, 2 Corinthians 12:14 teaches us that children should not lay up for their parents, but parents for their children. At first, this seems to have little to do with national and state law, but does it not follow, by good and necessary consequence, that a nation should not accumulate an astronomical debt and pass it on to the next generation? No doubt, in time of war, as in times of emergencies in a family, the budget may be unbalanced. It is also true that in exceptional cases, cases of misfortune and tragedy, children may have to provide for their parents. But the general principle is that each generation should take care of itself, and if possible, hand on to the next, not debts, but assets. Thus, the policy of the United States government stands condemned as immoral and anti-Christian. Not only in fiscal irresponsibility has the United States violated the law of God, while it was quite proper for the Supreme Court to prohibit the imposition of officially composed prayers in the schools, the prayer in question was utterly devoid of Christian sentiment. The boards of education and other lesser officials have seized the opportunity to harass Christian activity. The Gideons are prevented from giving New Testaments to children, though no tax money is used to buy the testaments. The University of California prohibits Christian girls from having a house or sorority of their own. They call it religious segregation. Christian girls must be forced to live with the type that frequents the beaches of Fort Lauderdale. That is democracy. Surely a review of history teaches the evils of governmentally enforced religion. We do not want an established church. But also we do not want an established atheism. School officials who interfere with Christian activity should be relieved of their jobs. There is a story going the rounds that a teacher saw several boys on their knees in a corner. When she came near, she saw that they were shooting craps. She breathed a sigh of relief, for she had been in mortal terror that they might have been praying. The connection between Christian principle, the education of children, and the affairs of state is exemplified in the Air Cadet scandal of 1965. In the Air Academy at Colorado Springs, there was widespread cheating on examinations. Its magnitude is clear from the fact that about 100 cadets had to resign. They had been discovered to be morally unfit for the rank of an officer. The nation loses 100 officers because of mass cheating. And how did this occur? Well, this wholesale dishonesty came by way of the products of our public schools. The public schools are forbidden to teach Christian standards. These young men had been raised under the influence of a materialistic, statist, godless system. Success is what counts. But this time they were not successful. They got caught. How many others in other schools are not caught? This is the corruption that permeates our national life. From the office of the president on down, there are scandals, murder, syndicates, riots, and destruction of property, not to mention the much-advertised sexual decay among the fraternities and sororities as they gather for their wild festivities. Evil education has been warping American youth for years. There is no easy way to reverse the trend. Atheism and immorality are entrenched. One thing that is needed is powerful preaching of the law of God. Right is right because God commands it. Wrong is what God forbids. There is no other basis for moral distinctions. If, however, the world will not hear the preaching of righteousness, if it loves its sins as the people of Sodom did, then at least we can examine our own lives and see if there is any wicked way in us. The law of God is a lamp on our pathway and a light to our feet. By taking heed thereto, a young man, and an older man too, may correct his ways.